Shame is never a motivator for change. It shouldn't be so difficult to accept that, but yet so many providers still operate from that place, unfortunately.
Welcome to Shoulders Down, a podcast about intuitive eating and living. I'm your host, Leah Kern, and I'm an anti-diet dietitian and certified intuitive eating counselor. In this podcast, you will learn to harness your body's innate wisdom to govern not just how you eat, but also how you live. It is my mission to help you heal your relationship with food and body so you can live your most aligned and fulfilling life. Welcome, and I'm so glad that you're here. Hello, and welcome back to Shoulders Down. I hope that you are doing well. If you celebrate the Jewish New Year, Rosh Hashanah, wishing you a sweet new year, Shana Tova, and hopefully this year is full of sweet things, food freedom, no more diet culture, no more oppressive, restrictive diet mentality, trusting yourself more, leaning into your intuition, and breaking free of exterior rules and metrics that were designed to keep you small. And when I say small, I don't mean physically, I mean energetically, but also physically, I guess. That's what diet culture promises, smallness, thinness. Wow, that got deep. I didn't realize that's what was going to come out of my mouth first thing this morning. So today we have a great episode for you. My friend Mia is coming on the podcast. Mia is a intuitive eating dietitian as well as a professor at a college in Washington State. Mia and I met at through a group that we were in together. We were in this mindset mastermind for entrepreneurs, and it was really special. It was me and Mia and a therapist, another, and then like two other nutrition professionals. So it was a really special time, and we did a lot of powerful work, just around mindset in business, especially as a female entrepreneur. So just a little backstory. I think we reference, our connection through that group in the interview. So that's what we were referring to. And before we get into the interview with Mia, I am going to answer a listener question. So this is a fun segment. If you're new here, you have the opportunity to submit questions via the link in the show notes. And any questions, intuitive eating, body image, all are welcome. And I will maybe answer it on an upcoming episode. So today's listener question comes from a listener named Susan, and she says, help, please. She says, help, please. I can't stop the tally in my head that is tracking calories all day. I feel you, Susan. I've been there. I remember that feeling. Many of my clients share the same feeling. Before I go ahead and tackle this question, I just want to give my standard disclaimer here, which is that all content in this podcast is for informational and educational purposes only. The information and education provided is not intended or implied to supplement or replace professional medical treatment, advice, or diagnoses. And I'm only one person with one lived experience as well. So I encourage you to seek out insights from folks with other lived experiences, as well as consulting your own inner wisdom. So with that, Susan, I would love to answer this question. I think it's a really important point. Even when you stop using your calorie tracking apps and stop, you know, quit using diet rules, it can be hard to let go of the residual thoughts and rules and beliefs that are so deeply ingrained in the brain from probably years and years of calorie tracking or macro tracking or point tracking or following whatever rule. So this is really common. I first just want you to know that you are not alone in this experience. And so what I like to say here is that the expectation that the internal kind of calorie tracker is going to go away immediately is really unrealistic, because, I mean, I don't have all the pieces of your story here, but my guess would be if you're experiencing this, that you probably had been tracking calories for quite some time. So we just want to think about that in terms of like giving ourselves compassion of like, I always ask my clients, how long were you in diet culture? Many of them are like, oh my gosh, I was dieting or restricting or, you know, counting calories or whatever it is for like 10, 15, 20 years. Some of them, it's even more than that, 30 years, you know, depending on their age. And so with you, I would just invite you to reflect on how long was I tracking calories on a calorie app, counting app for? And then thinking about, okay, how long has it been since I've been on the journey of giving up tracking calories, giving up using an app, giving up diet mentality, diet culture? And just kind of looking at that, I'm sure the answer is that, you know, it hasn't been that long since you ventured into the world of intuitive eating and rejecting calorie counting. And I'm sure that it's been the case of, you know, many, many, many more years in that diet mentality. So from like a brain chemistry perspective, your neural pathways that support calorie counting are so much more deeply embedded, whereas the neural pathways that support eating according to your intuition, not some arbitrary, you know, app's recommendation on numbers or whatever that, you know, that your story is with calorie counting, the experience of trying to use your intuition is so much more new, and therefore it makes sense that it's going to feel a little bit more foreign, and that the old thoughts and chatter in your brain about calories and numbers is still loud. So I hope that can give you a moment to just really have compassion for yourself here. And so when the calorie numbers creep into your brain, I would invite you to just like kind of get curious about them. And so say you have, you know, you go to eat a certain food and your brain's like, well, you know, it's this many calories. The first thing here is just recognizing of like, oh, this is my old wiring. That is the reason that I like know the calories of all of these foods. And my new mindset is not to be concerned with these numbers. It's instead to check in with what feels right and good for my body. So you might say something like, hi, calorie number, I hear you. I see you. You know, you are a product of many years of living in the diet mentality. And right now, I'm going to choose to listen to my body and ask it what it needs instead of listening to you, you being this personified calorie chatter. This like, you can picture like a little calorie creature. I don't know, that just came up with that, but I love to personify things. It my brain works like that. You can picture like a little calorie creature who like chirps up, and the pieces you want to do are, one, bring awareness of like, hello, calorie creature. I don't know, maybe you name it, maybe you call it that, maybe that doesn't resonate for you. This is just one option, one tool. And then you can kind of say, I see you. I understand why you're here. You're here because for so long I relied on you to make eating decisions. And I'm kindly gonna like just ask you to step aside and so I can check in with my body, because that's the path that I'm on right now. So this kind of personification and like talking to yourself and kind of having these conversations between different parts of yourself is a tool I use often in counseling with my clients. And it's valuable for a few reasons. One, the baseline of just even noticing of like, oh, that thing's happening again where I happen to know the number of calories and everything and I can't stop tracking it. This is a product of my own old mindset. What that's doing is, one, bringing awareness, and awareness is the start to change, right? Like, we can't change a thought or behavior that we don't even realize or not even conscious of that we're having. And the second piece is validation of like, I understand why this is happening. It's valid that this is happening. This is a product of so many years living by that calorie tracker. And when we validate our experience, it allows our bodies to help build trust with us, because they're like, oh, you're seeing me, you're hearing me, you're seeing my experience is valid. Instead of if, say, you heard that internal calorie tracker going and you were like, nope, I'm not going to listen to that. Shh, like, shut it out. Let's just like focus on listening to our body. What I find with my clients and also in my personal life is that just jumping to the reframe without first validating the emotions and experience that is coming up can feel very invalidating, and therefore it can cause your body this experience of not trusting you, because your body's like, no, hey, we're having this experience. We're like, we are thinking about calories. Like, don't just try to shove this under the rug and tell us that we aren't. And so instead of just trying to invalidate and move right on to the reframe, taking that moment of like, I see you. I understand why this is happening. It's valid that this is happening. This is happening because it's a behavior that, you know, used to serve us in some way. It used to give us an illusion of control or a feeling like we were like, quote unquote, being good. And now we know like this actually wasn't serving us in the long run. It just caused obsession and feelings of being out of control and guilt, etc. So this framework that I use with clients is very simply called the AND statement, and it's not something I've created. It's a common approach to therapy and to reframing thoughts. And the structure is very simply: validate how the comment or thought is making you feel. Use the word "and." So I'm noticing I'm thinking about calories. It's making me feel a little triggered from my old days. And then on the other side of the word "and" is a reframe. So something like, I'm working on remembering that I can now govern my eating decisions from my body's cues, or I'm on a different path now. I'm on an intuitive eating path now. Any of these things can work here. So I hope that's a helpful kind of like way to attack it from an internal dialogue perspective. Some other things that help: if you have a lot of foods that are like, I don't know, say like a box of cereal, and like you sit down to eat the cereal and you can't help but like flip over the box and look at the calories or whatever. Another thing that could be helpful is pouring out the cereal into like a plastic container or something. So that kind of takes away that trigger. That's something that sometimes is helpful for folks depending on where they're at in their journey. The other piece here is like, when that little calorie creature comes up and he, she, they is like, well, you know, Susan, that has like, you know, X amount of calories, you can literally talk to it and ask it like, okay, calorie creature, what's so bad about a thing having calories? Calories are not morally good or bad. It's just a form of giving the body energy. And so, yeah, that thing has that many calories. Like, you could literally talk back to the calorie creature and sass it a little and just say like, yeah, that means that if it's a number that you perceive as a high amount of calories, you could just reframe that without this tinge of morality and be like, yeah, that means that it's energy dense and will give me my body energy for, you know, a longer amount of time, or keep me fuller for a longer amount of time. This can help take things from the realm of morality to just like a very objective realm of just like, yes, it does have that many calories. And that means that, you know, it has that much energy and that will serve my body in some way. So this can be a way to kind of reframe another option of reframing, of just facing it and saying, yeah, like it does have this many calories. And also like this doesn't mean anything about me or the kind of person I am. Another thing I often see with clients is often their perception of what is quote unquote high calorie, what is low calorie, is very much skewed from so many years of downloading all this diet propaganda. And so often clients will be like, oh my God, I'm eating so much. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, this is a really within the realm of what makes sense for fueling a body. And they're like, really? Like, and I'm like, yeah, like, you know, given what they share, you know, that they're eating. And so often it's the case where diet culture, diet mentality has skewed the perception of what is a lot of food or a high calorie food because of its propaganda, its messaging, its marketing. So that's another thing to keep in mind. And then the last thing I want to offer here, Susan, is just the journey of healing disordered relationship with food, these obsessive thoughts about food. It's often very gradual. And so I talk about this a lot with clients, like who struggle, for example, with binge eating. The expectation that you're going to go from having pretty consistent binges to just like, boom, no more binges, they're not a problem anymore, is unrealistic. What's more realistic is this kind of like, when you do have binges, the frequency will be less and less and less, and the magnitude will be less and less and less. So you won't have binges as often. And when you do, they won't be to the same extent of like so much pain in your body and, you know, feeling so ill and sick. So I apply that here too with, you know, the expectation of how you will heal these internal chatter about, you know, these rules and beliefs and restrictions around calories. The expectation that it will just go away overnight, even when you've done some of the intuitive eating work, is unrealistic. What is more realistic is that the thoughts might still pop up. You might still be like, oh, X food has X calories, but the reaction is what will start changing, instead of like, so that means that, you know, I can only have this much, or I should, you know, cut this in half, or, you know, restrict what I eat later. that piece is what will be different. I'll be like, okay, this food has, you know, X food has X calories. Okay, what's so bad about that? You know, that just means that it has this much energy. I trust that my body will be able to govern, you know, the amount of food that I need, and will be able to communicate to me the kinds of food it needs. So that I hope can help you see that the expectation that the internal calorie tracker just completely shuts off all of a sudden is unrealistic. But what we're looking for here is, when the thoughts pop in, how do you reframe? How do you kind of chirp back to this calorie creature, if that metaphor even resonates with you? I'm just running with it because it's an easy way to talk about it. But anyway, anyhow, how do you speak back to these thoughts? How do you reframe? And what you probably will find, what I think I can say is true for a lot of my clients, and was true in my own experience with healing my relationship with food, is it just slowly fades out. And, you know, all these years later, maybe I can still sit here and know these arbitrary numbers about the amounts of calories in random snacks and foods. But the difference is that it lives in a deep place in my brain, in like a filing cabinet with a ton of dust on it that I don't really ever pull out, because it doesn't matter to me. What matters to me is how my body feels and what it is telling me it needs. So I hope that's helpful for you, Susan. Thanks for this great question. And again, if you have a question of your own that you want to hear answered on the show, you want a chance to have it answered on an upcoming episode, you can submit it via the link in the show notes, and it would be my absolute honor to take a stab at it. Okay, so with that, let's introduce Mia and dive into the episode. Mia is an anti-diet dietitian with a Master of Public Health in Nutritional Sciences from the University of Washington. She helps lifelong dieters break away from toxic diet culture and empowers them to build trust with their bodies. Her signature online program called Body Respect has helped hundreds of women break the cycle of food guilt and body shame and replace it with food freedom, body appreciation, and self-love. In addition to her online practice, she's a nutrition faculty at Seattle Pacific University. She's a strong anti-diet advocate and believes that all bodies, regardless of weight and size, deserve respectful and compassionate care. Welcome to the podcast, Mia. So excited to be on a call with you, seeing your face, catching up after a few months of having seen each other in our mentorship group.
Very excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Of course. So we're going to just dive right in with such a universal question that's interesting to hear people talk through. And that is, what is your story with your relationship with food and body?
So I think I was pretty fortunate to have a pretty protected relationship with food, where I didn't grow up with the good food, bad food mentality. Food was just food. All foods were allowed. And it's kind of funny. I remember my mom kind of talking about how I was a pretty picky eater until I was 3-4 years old. And the only thing that she could get me to eat consistently was McDonald's French fries. She was like, you ate McDonald's French fries every day for, like, you know, 2 years of your life. I was like, great. No wonder I still have a pretty strong preference for, I think it's the best fries, right? So that's a little snippet into my childhood relationship with food. And of course, going through puberty and getting all the diet culture messages, I definitely grew up with thoughts of, you know, parts of my body that I wasn't happy about. And I kind of grew up going back and forth between Korea and in the States. And it's kind of funny how that impacted me too, where, you know, here I was, you know, a small kid, and didn't think differently. Although, of course, you know, I thought I looked different because I grew up in very suburban, you know, predominantly white neighborhoods. And then when I moved to Korea in my teenage years, I was starting to compare myself to the, you know, very petite, you know, the Asian current, like the Asian standard of the thin ideal, which can be even more extreme than the Western ideal. And so a lot of comparison started to come in, and I dabbled into different diets in teenage years and in college, but it wasn't. Food and body was never an excruciating, like, difficult piece of my life. I think I've just impacted to the degree that any, you know, teenager and going through puberty would for anyone living in diet culture, really. And the funny thing is how, you know, I had a different career. This is my second career. And when I finally decided to come into nutrition, and that was just from my own life epiphany of, oh, I've been neglecting my own self-care, food, my eating is all over the place. I'm not doing anything to, you know, care for myself, exercise or anything like that. And so I decided to, that's how I got interested in nutrition. But funny enough, I thought that I would become a dietitian to tell everyone to stop eating your sugar and eat all your quote unquote healthy foods. And I went through my own kind of orthorexic phase and turned vegetarian for 5 years until I actually was in grad school for nutrition. And I was introduced to the idea of intuitive eating and health at every size pretty early on, fortunately, also in grad school, and then also in my eating disorder training, which I did a year-long adolescent medicine fellowship out of grad school, working at a children's hospital here in Seattle. And all the dietitians there practice from a non-diet weight inclusive approach. And that really opened my eyes up to all the ideas of weight bias, fat phobia, and what was wrong with our weight centered medical system. And so it was a really eye-opening experience. That's the first time I became aware of my own thin privilege that I grew up with, even though I had my own difficulties here and there. Of course, I still live in a small body that society doesn't deem as wrong or bad or large. Mm-hmm. And so it really kind of shook me up in how I thought about food, viewed bodies personally, but totally shaped my professional trajectory in a different way than I ever imagined it to be. And so, yeah, that's kind of a snippet of my own story.
Yeah, your story is unique in that, like you said, you grew up with that protected relationship with food. And it almost sounds like, aside from, you know, the exposure to a different culture in Korea, it sounds like almost the more disordered thoughts came in parallel to entering the field of nutrition.
That is the case, really, because until then, you know, food was just food. I joke about how in college I ate a Whopper Junior cheeseburger every single day because nothing else on campus sounded good. And throughout my, you know, first corporate career, for the most part, even though my eating may have been chaotic, but I never had that good food, bad food mentality that a lot of people who struggle with food, you know, a lot of our clients struggle with. And it wasn't until I actually came into the world of nutrition that that was there for a pretty short period of time. And I think for a lot of nutrition students or health focused students, right? Like now I work in a university setting in addition to my private practice. And there are statistics and studies that show the prevalence of disordered eating is actually higher in those who study nutrition and those mm-hmm. who are in health majors. And it's really probably not a coincidence.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I think it's also unique that you had exposure to health at every size and intuitive eating so early on in your career. I think so often from doing this podcast and having so many dietitians on and also my own experience, you know, it's actually my own experience. It's not true. I had exposure early on because I had an awesome professor. But so many dietitians say they, you know, started counseling on weight loss and started counseling from the weight normative standpoint and then realize this isn't right and transitioned, you know, after they were already doing it. So it's really cool to hear you had that exposure and mentorship. It sounds like at that fellowship really early on.
Mm-hmm. I feel very fortunate about that for sure.
That's awesome. So the piece of your story that's being a professor. So tell us about how that part came to be. You know, you're in private practice. What inspired you to take your career to that place?
Mm-hmm. So it was definitely not the trajectory that I was expecting or ever even considered, which is interesting because my dad's a professor and my mom and dad always wanted me to become a professor. And I always thought that was, you know, not my track. I was like, no, I have no interest in teaching. And yet here we are. And so it was never intended, but out of that fellowship, what I became sure of was that I fell in love with the adolescent population. I also fell in love with the field of disordered eating and eating disorders, because as you know very well, it's so much more than about just food and body, and it goes so much deeper. And that's what really drew me in. My client's story drew me in. And so I first got a position at the university in the student counseling center as the counseling dietitian among 20 therapists. And so that was the beginning of my dietitian career. And I ended up staying in that position, which was, you know, less than just short of a full-time position for 7 years. So wow. That was my first door into my first career as a dietitian. And then I got connected to the nutrition department. And they asked if I wanted to do some guest speaking. So I started to go in and do some guest speaking on anti-diet, non-diet approaches and about intuitive eating, about eating disorders. And then the next quarter, they asked if I wanted to teach a course as an adjunct. Like, okay. So that's how I got my door into, you know, teaching, and eventually was offered a half-time position, which is what I have right now. And so it just kind of happened organically in that way. Yeah. And my practice was something that started in addition to that. So it was actually, I started at the university. I'm still there, no longer at the counseling center, but in that teaching, and just really fell in love with it. It's a different aspect of the nutrition work. And it feels so rewarding to, you know, be able to give that exposure that I got very early on, and to be able to play that role in the new and early careers of my students has been a really rewarding part of my work.
Absolutely. I first of all, your students are so lucky to have you, because I see your passion come through and the content you share, and just from knowing you on a personal level from the program that we did together. And I really think of a professor I had who like totally rocked my world. And I know that's the effect, like, in general, students would say she has, because if you have a student coming in who's never heard of intuitive eating or HACE, and you get to be the one to be like, let me like open your eyes to this whole other world, I can only imagine if that's like such a gratifying experience.
Oh yeah. Just hearing you say that back to me, I got chills a little bit, because it really is that. And I just thought of a student that I had early on, which it was really interesting, where it was probably 6-7 years ago. So early in my, pretty early in my career, she came in first as my client. So she was a nutrition major, and at that time I wasn't teaching yet. So she was a client of mine who was on that border of a disorder eating and a restrictive eating disorder. And we started counseling process in her sophomore year. And then 2 years later, I became her professor. And in the nutrition counseling class, I exposed, you know, her to the ideas of intuitive eating and health at every size. And that year, I also oversaw, we did our own version of Eating Disorder Awareness Week, which at Seattle Pacific University, it's Body Positive Week. And so we had a, you know, a student committee who would plan the Body Positive Week long activities, and she became a part of that committee. And so by the time that she graduated as a senior, she wrote me a card that said, thank you so much for the impact that you've had as my counselor, as my professor, and as my mentor in the Body Positive Committee. And I will take the teachings that I have from you, you know, as I become a registered dietitian. Yeah. And I just heard from her last year. And she saw me speak at a virtual conference that I spoke from, and she was just, you know, expressing her gratitude about me continuing to do this work, but also how she has been practicing from that lens as well. And so it was just a beautiful full circle moment that I felt so grateful to, you know, hear about.
I mean, talk about the impact, like ripple effects, because I think about in our one-to-one work, it's like, okay, you work with a client and that has a ripple effect, because now if they, you know, in a really concrete example, have children, for example, they're now breaking the chain of inherited body hate and dieting in their family. So there's a ripple effect there. And in a less concrete way, if they don't have children, they're just like one less person spreading diet propaganda in the world because they've done the healing. And I think about on this, like, that's like a micro level almost, but then there's like this macro level of like, you're teaching all these students and they're going out and maybe counseling or teaching in whatever form. It's so cool that I mean, like, sitting here, like, do I want to be a professor? Like, that's like, great. I'm like, Mia, I think you just like made something click.
You can always get connected to, you know, local universities and do some guest speaking. I think that's a great way to break into teaching and just experiment with it and see, like, would I like this, right? It's a new experience, because that's how it happened for me too. Yeah.
It was interesting hearing your story in, because it sounds like when you say it wasn't your plan, I really hear that, and that you were just counseling on campus, not with any intention to be a professor.
Exactly.
And so interesting. So kind of shifting a little, I always like hearing about the moment you described, like, you had this early exposure to intuitive eating and health at every size. Can you remember your initial reaction to learning about these frameworks? Obviously, they're both, you know, in many ways, very counterculture to kind of the mainstream weight normative ideas and approaches. Can you remember your first reaction to learning about these frameworks?
That's a great question. And, you know, I hear a lot of stories from other people about their moments of that. And interesting enough, I don't recall a specific moment or feeling. But what I think happened was it didn't happen in a way where I first learned about health at every size and intuitive eating. I first learned about weight bias. And that was the gateway into it, because what was happening at the adolescent medicine clinic at Seattle Children's was that not only were they seeing clients with eating disorders, but they were also seeing clients with difficulty in their weight spectrums. And they didn't use the words, you know, quote unquote, overweight and obese, which I already thought was, oh, they work on weight issues. But, you know, so they were being very careful in different ways, in ways that I had no idea, like there was a whole world around. And when I started to hear about how, you know, there are clients who struggle with weight and we can support them in their, you know, nutrition environment and behaviors and consider all the other factors that may contribute to their difficulty of taking care of themselves, but it wasn't put in a way where, oh, they're in a larger body, therefore their body is a problem and we're going to help them lose weight. So it was, that was, I do remember that kind of surprise of this different way of looking at quote unquote a weight issue, right? Because, you know, now I think they even don't even use that word weight issue because it's not an issue. It's not an issue. But it was way too, it was just that different population that they were serving. And I could see from there that it was really no different from how they were implementing interventions and treatment for those with anorexia and restrictive eating disorders, because we were doing on both sides, helping people, these teenagers, get back in touch with their body's cues and learn how to trust the body's cues, whether they were having difficulty with restricting or maybe, you know, overriding their fullness signals and having difficulty with that, or feeling unhappy in their bodies. And so I think that was the first kind of initial entrance into this world of, wait a minute, just kind of having that curiosity and questioning of what I was taught in that weight normative approach. And then from there came, oh, and there's this whole approach called Health at Every Size that embodies these ways of being a weight inclusive, having a weight inclusive approach and not seeing, again, weight as the problem and the culprit and the cause of everything. And then here's a way of, you know, the food aspect of intuitive eating. And so I think that's how it happened.
Such a unique story of your way in, because I, so many people that I talk to, it's, they are presented with the research and there's like this dissonance period, but you saw it play out in real life. And then the research was like, yeah, obviously this is supporting what I experienced or witnessed.
I think that's exactly it. It was, I got to see the lived experiences. And so there was no questioning about it. Right. So to me, it wasn't a cognitive process. It was just a, kind of a more direct experience of, oh, there was nothing to question when I was, you know, presented with stories of real, you know, people and could see the impact of this compassionate weight inclusive approach could have, and then putting names to what we were doing. And then here's the evidence and here's the research, you know, there wasn't a struggle for me to accept that because I got to see it in that way.
So interesting. Such a really unique path in. Just to define these words that we're throwing around, as I'm realizing maybe people don't understand, because there's so many different ways of referring to this, weight inclusive versus like weight normative, or maybe there's a different way that you like to draw that distinction. Can you just define those for the people listening?
Yeah. So the weight normative approach would be the more weight focused, using BMI as an indicator of someone's health and wellness status. Really, that's the way the majority of the medical community still operates under. Unfortunately, that is the way that most health professionals are taught. That's the way that we were kind of taught, right? Which is interesting, because in my grad school, even though I had exposure to intuitive eating, there was still a lot of weight focused and weight biased teachings as well, as opposed to a weight inclusive approach, which we're shifting the focus away from weight and really looking at a person from a holistic view of, oh, what are the physical factors going on? What are the emotional and mental factors going on? What are the objective data in terms of their, what we see in their chart? What are the psychosocial factors that influence them as a human being, and taking in all those factors and considering it all before we move on to providing an intervention and working with them. And so another way that I like to frame it is like a really an anti-diet approach, right? And that we're not focused on changing somebody's weight, and we're looking at them again as a holistic person.
Yeah, Thank you for defining that. Yeah. And for someone tuning in who like maybe hasn't listened to previous episodes and the concept of health at every size is really new, just this idea too of like suggesting to someone that, you know, they must lose weight and that is the problem. There's a large body of research now supporting that that doesn't work because one, we have no sustainable and healthy way to achieve long-term weight loss. And two, it creates a sense of shame when, you know, my body's wrong and I also can't achieve this ask that I lose weight because there is no long-term and sustainable way to lose weight. And then that shame has a lot of downstream negative effects, like not going to the doctor because the doctor was a person who shamed you. And then not going to the doctor has negative health effects. So just, I mean, this is a whole topic of its own, but just to start seeing why weight normative isn't supportive to someone's health.
Mm-hmm. Shame is never a motivator for change. Shame is never can be a part of a health, any health approach, right? And so it shouldn't be so difficult to accept that, but yet still so many providers still operate from that place, unfortunately. I just had a client I got off a call with this morning who had difficulty with her feet and her ligament after her pregnancy. And when she went to see a physical therapist, that person asked, "Did you gain weight during your pregnancy?" And we were like, "What kind of question is that?"
Yeah, right? I would hope so.
And even when it's not saying anything shameful, that just like implication that you get is still very shameful.
Right. Right. Absolutely. So going back to your career as a professor, how long have you been a professor again?
Teaching in some capacity for 6 years.
Okay. So over the last 6 years, I think about how much more research has come out in the health at every size and intuitive eating world as these frameworks have become more widely known and become popularized. So I'm curious how the design of your curriculum or your teaching style has changed as the research has become more readily available and more robust.
Mm-hmm. Again, because I was exposed to these ideas pretty early on. And so my teachings and curriculums have always been a weight inclusive approach. And I teach now 5 courses in our undergraduate program. And no matter what class it is, I will include some aspect of health at every size, weight bias, to meet the curriculum's needs, but also to not frame it in that harmful approach. And so that has not changed so much. Of course, I continue to add on to the research that I provide for students, and update that, but the overall curriculum has not really changed. And I've been surprised at just how receptive, students have really been. And I think it helps to start with the fact that when I introduce them to any of these ideas, I always start with acknowledging the cognitive dissonance that might be happening, because I don't only teach nutrition students, I teach a large body of nursing, you know, pre-nursing students, those who want to go to med school and other health professions. And so to normalize, if this is the first time you're hearing this, you might have a lot of questions and a lot of doubt and But wait a minute. And to really normalize that and have an open conversation about it has been a really helpful gateway into having those conversations with students.
Yeah, I love that you do that, setting expectations of like, this dissonance is so normal. Like, you have been steeped in a completely different paradigm for me to just stand up here and be like, actually, all of that is actually not the case. It's going to create a lot of doubt. And so that was my next question is like, how do you navigate the students? It sounds like in general, they're fairly receptive. But how do you navigate situations where my old professor calls them diet champions, where you have people who are like, certainly I know with a tight fist, I know that, you know, weight must be an indicator of health or whatever they're asserting. How do you navigate pushback from these students?
That's an interesting question. I don't think I've had such a strong case of that. Or maybe they haven't voiced it if I did have students like that. I think having an approach where I come from a lot of evidence has been a way that has minimized a lot of the resistance, where a lot of the research articles that I provide for them go through a lot of debunking the questions and thoughts that they might have, and that compare the long-term effects of a weight normative and a weight inclusive approach, and how, of course, there is that kind of 5% of the unicorn population where, oh, but I am, you know, able to keep this, you know, weight loss off, but also bringing in a lot of real life examples. And so often the conversation starts with, do you know anyone in your life who has gone through a lot of yo-yo dieting and has lost weight, gained weight, lost weight, gained weight, and then some more? What do you think is happening there? So it's not just, you know, me telling them what's happening, but they get to share their own, either their own experiences or someone in their life experiences, a lot of clinical case studies of clients that I've worked with. And I think just like, because that was a way where I minimized a lot of my, resolved a lot of my questions and doubts, is from having those real life stories. Stories are powerful. I give them this slide of three cases where, you know, here's a client who is in a normal, quote unquote, normal BMI, but is starving herself and spending hours in the gym, and she passed out a couple of times. And then here's someone who lives in a larger body and eats three meals and some snacks a day. All her labs are normal, but she lives in a larger body, you know, these different cases. And right. who is healthy? Who is physically healthy? What would you want? How would you want to help them as a provider, right? Like having these conversations and with these real concrete examples, I think has helped us, you know, get through a lot of that. And I haven't had such a strong voice that came against it, surprisingly, in the past.
Wow. That is surprising, because I feel like, I think of college students kind of like typically as like, you know, in that age of like being like really wanting to challenge things and like really trying to like, you know, look at things critically for maybe for the first time in their life. So it really surprises me. I wonder too, I feel like people are getting exposed to intuitive eating and health at every size now, like through like social media and other avenues. So maybe, I mean, I don't know, hypothesis here, but I wonder if, you know, maybe like 10, 15 years ago, if it would have looked different in class, whereas now maybe this isn't the first time they're hearing some of these ideas.
I think that's very true too. Just in the 6 year span of doing the work, whereas 6 years ago, there was a lot more students who was hearing it from the first time from me, I think that number has drastically changed, especially with nutrition students. I don't think I'm really ever the first person to tell them about intuitive eating with my nutrition majors, but it still might be the case with my non-majors.
Yeah, that makes sense. So if not from the students, I'm curious if you ever encounter other faculty members who are still teaching or practicing from weight normative approach. And if so, how do you navigate this?
That's the bigger question. And our faculty pool is pretty small. So including myself, there's, you know, four regular faculty, and then we have, you know, some adjunct faculty members. And it's interesting because most others still do teach from the weight inclusive approach. And yet it's interesting because they recognize Haze and intuitive eating as a valid non-diet approach, but I think they have this kind of compartmentalization of, here's how you help someone lose weight, and here are non-diet approaches of how you can help someone. And there isn't the reconciliation between, you know, but you can't have both of them, right? Yeah. So that's where things are, where, and I'm still kind of treading in the waters of how to kind of navigate that, where they completely see and respect how I practice. They've seen me how I practice when I was in the counseling center. They know that my approach is very set in the non-diet approaches, even clinically. And they might even ask me to come in and do a snippet of a presentation about Haze, and yet they still teach MNT from that weight normative approach. And so that's still a question that I continue to ask myself of how we will continue to navigate this, where I'm not directly challenging them, and yet I'm continuing to think about how we can further kind of create that, have that reconciliation as a program and as a curriculum itself.
Yeah.
And so if I can add to that, there's a pretty cool thing happening so for the first time for the AND, the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, and you know that there's a DPGs, the practice groups within our professional academy. There's a nutrition educators and proctors group. And For the first time for the Academy, we have an official Weight Inclusive Toolkit Committee that is a pool of very diverse population of dietitians. And the goal is to create a toolkit, a weight inclusive toolkit, to disseminate to all undergraduate programs in the US. And to
amazing.
Yeah, wow. It's pretty amazing. So this has been going on for the past year, and I'm part of the DEI committee there. And the most diverse set of dietitians I've ever seen, because as you know, our profession is very predominantly white and female and thin. And so a very diverse population that we are considering various aspects of diversity. And the goal is to complete this toolkit by next June and to start working with different schools to disseminate it. And the big part of the conversation here, which I've brought up with the committee a few times, is not just how we're going to create this toolkit, but how we're going to talk to and communicate with the faculty members at each school because of those very reasons that I'm thinking about. Yeah. Because we can't have the candid conversations and get the faculty on board, how will we have them teach this when they're not on board with it themselves, or they haven't done the work to face their own weight biases? So I think that is a big part of the challenge, but it's a pretty exciting development that's happening at a bigger level that has never happened before.
Thank you for sharing that. That makes me so excited. And I think about, like, when you were sharing, you share so much robust research as part of your curriculum. That's amazing. And also, you know, it's labor intensive to assemble all of that and to develop curriculum and case studies and all these things that you've built probably over the years. And so I think about taking that piece out of the, like, taking that hurdle away and saying, well, here's materials, and giving people the tools they need to start implementing this, you know, versus people being like, I don't know where to start. Like, I know this is, like, cognitively probably where the field is going and this is the right thing, but, like, feeling like it's too overwhelming to even start diving into.
Mm-hmm. It's cool to have that with, you know, just kind of the development happening with a collective pool of diverse array of individuals, because I'm also continuing to kind of see different ways where my own kind of privileges and biases might have also continue to influence the way I see things. Right, our work is never over. We continue to grow and learn and evolve and, you know, own up to our own mistakes, because no one is perfect. And it's been such an eye-opening experience to get to witness that with other practitioners that normally, like, we wouldn't get a chance to get together with. So that's been pretty amazing.
It's so powerful that the people who are working on creating these tools to disseminate to the universities, that it sounds like some of the most diverse group of dietitians, because as you mentioned, the field is very much not diverse, because I think about too the ripple there of if they're the ones, their brains and their lived experience are going into creating these tools, and then these tools are going to be used to teach others, then suddenly we're having, you know, much more kind of diverse and well-rounded nutrition education going out to future nutrition professionals.
Exactly.
That's incredible. That makes me so excited. I'm not a professor, but I want to have access to those tools just to even use with clients. I think that's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
In your work, you talk about giving yourself time to grieve the thin ideal. This is just something, as I was scrolling through your social media, something that struck me that I think would be helpful to talk about here. Why is this a necessary step of body image healing? And also, what is the thin ideal for someone who hasn't heard that term before?
Mm-hmm. So the thin ideal is, you know, even though the specific of that might look different to each individual's, but overall, this idea that we hold in society that a thinner body is a better body, that a thinner body is a good body, a healthy body, a worthy body. And when clients start to kind of come to the realization that trying to achieve that thin ideal that feels impossible has only destructed my relationship with food and body, and I'm done with it. And so they come into this work and say, okay, I want to make peace with food and with my body and build trust. And I don't want to chase after that thin ideal for the rest of my life. However, you know, it's hard. That's not something that you can just switch off overnight. And even as I'm talking about this, I think it's also just important to recognize and acknowledge that I am a thin person from societal standards. And so I feel very careful even talking about someone potentially in a larger body grieving the thin ideal coming from a thin person, that can still feel like you know, that I don't have that lived experience, and I don't. So I just acknowledge that. However, in, you know, my work with clients, and I think a big part of what we do is creating a space where we can sit with, allow clients to sit with whatever uncomfortable feelings that they're going through. And oftentimes for those in larger bodies who are coming into the space of making peace with food and body, it is about grappling with that idea of, yeah, I don't want to diet. I don't want to control my body. I don't want to hate myself. And I still can't get over the desire that I want weight loss.
Yeah.
And it's so understandable. Why wouldn't anyone want to be in a thin body if they could? Because we still live in a very fat phobic society. And that's just the really hard truth. And yet, and so I think it really, what grieving that thin ideal means is that we can sit with multiple truths. So to acknowledge both, because what I've seen in my work with clients is they feel they can't, or maybe they don't deserve to make peace with food and body unless they've gotten over that weight loss desire. It's like, I can't truly do this yet because I'm still holding on to this, or I feel guilty because I still want weight loss. And that's not something to feel guilty about. That's something to have compassion for yourself about. Right. And so that's what I mean when the having need to grieve and to need that space to grieve. And so what that grieving could look like is, you know, again, could be different for everyone, but it means not to rush yourself to quote unquote, get over weight loss, to really think about what that means to you. And it's like any other loss where if you think about losing a loved one or, you know, maybe losing a relationship, how there's a lot of mixed complicated emotions that come with that. And we can't just say, oh, it's all going to be okay. And now we have to move on without giving space to think about what that loss means. So I think it's no different when we think about amending our relationship with our bodies. And in order to get to that place of saying, yeah, I really want to meet my body with kindness and take care of it. It's hard to get to that space without first sitting with the uncomfortable emotions and creating that space to move on to the next and doing what you, the direction that you want to go to in accepting yourself.
Right. Right. And leaving out this time and space to grieve is, has like toxic positivity energy of just like, it's okay. Like I'll be fine. Like anti-diet is great. And it's like, no, there's also really hard parts. And like you said, you can't just switch overnight to suddenly I don't care about something that I've been led to believe will give me happiness and acceptance and all of these things. Of course you still care. Like, of course, you know, and also you can care and also know that pursuing, you know, weight loss or manipulating the size or shape of your body in any way is not serving you. And this yes and situation of holding both kind of conflicting feelings at once, I think really speaks to how this work is not about black and white. And it's about, it's the gray area of, you know, more than one thing can be true and that's okay.
Absolutely. It's about navigating the messy middle. And messy that is middle. Exactly the crux of the messy middle right there.
Yeah, exactly. I also think about one other thing that came up for me as you were talking. It's grieving the thin ideal. We have the word grief. I think about the stages of grief and how there, it's not necessarily linear. There might be days when you're in denial, like this can't be happening, you know, or there might be days where I think like some people call it like sitting in the suck, where you're just like so angry and you're like, I've been promised something else. Like I've been promised that I could have this body if I want. And now I'm coming to realize, no, actually like that won't be possible or sustainable for me. I'm pissed. Like, and then I think about, bargaining, which I see a lot, and I'm sure you see a lot too, of like, well,
maybe one diet.
Yeah, just like one, I'll just diet a little, get to the body I want. And then I'll do this intuitive eating thing, which of course doesn't work. And then I think of, I don't think this stage of grief is always included in like traditional stages of grief, but I use it with my clients and that's making meaning, like finding meaning in the process, in the grieving. And I just think about how much you learn about yourself in the process of releasing the thin ideal. Who are you really if you're not this person who's trying to manipulate the size or shape of your body? And that is a hard process, not to invalidate that, but also a really beautiful process of getting to learn your authentic self, your authentic wants and desires.
Absolutely. I think, you know, just like any other difficulty in life, right? There's always growth and insight that comes from it. And I think this process is no different when we're able to really allow ourselves to feel whatever we feel. And these are the difficult feelings, anger, the grief, and yet there's so much power in those strong feelings too. And I think a lot of it is about not judging our feelings, not judging, you know, feeling bad, and allowing yourself to meet yourself where you are and say, okay, what does this mean? And how can I meet myself in this difficult time? And it can also be a beautiful opportunity to develop and practice a self-compassion, which so many of our clients who have difficulty with food and body have a hard time with, because they have that mean inner critic who's been judging themselves all their lives for the failed diets. Yeah. And here you are letting that go. And it's that process of meeting yourself with kindness and compassion.
Yeah, absolutely. So you bring up self-compassion, and I think you and I have talked about Kristen Neff's work before, being like the greatest of all time self-compassion go-to person, where we all think about. And I'd love to hear you just kind of share a little bit about, you bring up the inner critic and how come that's kind of counterintuitive to this work. Why is it that self-compassion is so central to intuitive eating?
Where do we start? So much there, right? So much to unpack there. But I love to start with the idea that, you know, what the definition of compassion is. Compassion means to sit with the suffering. And so self-compassion is sitting with yourself in that suffering. Because I think a lot of times the misconception is that, oh, self-compassion is this, you know, just warm, fuzzy feelings. You're just being nice to yourself, or you're like letting yourself off the hook and you're not going to improve, when that's really not the case. Because there's so much fear in this process, right? And the fear is often amplified by that mean inner critic. Oh, you're letting yourself go. You're going to just keep, you know, getting bigger and bigger. You're going to lose control. And when we get so overwhelmed by the inner critic, that activates our nervous system. And that doesn't allow you to take care of yourself, right? Like when your fight or flight system is activated, your body is just going to be in survival mode. When you're in survival mode, you're not hungry. You don't feel your body's cues. You're just going to be ready to run and flee and combat, you know, whatever imminent danger is there. And when we think about the fight or flight system, most people think, okay, when you're being chased by a bear, yes, but also emotional threats do the same thing that physical threats do. And so I talk a lot with my clients about when you're talking mean to yourself, it's like you have a predator coming at you at all times. Yeah. And you can't tune into your body. You can't, you know, rest and let your body recuperate. You can't, you know, tap into building that body trust that you're working so hard on doing with intuitive eating and this process of making peace with food and body, as opposed to having this self-compassionate voice. I call it our compassionate ally. When we can grow our compassionate ally against the self-critic, what you do is you're creating your own safe space. You know that when you have your best friend, the person you love the most and you trust the most, is comforting you and saying and holding you in your pain and saying, hey, I know this is really hard, but we're going to get through it together. And how safe you feel, how hopeful you feel, how encouraged you feel, that's what you're doing for yourself when you build self-compassion. And that allows you to be like, okay, you calm down your nervous system. Then you can feel your body's cues. Then you can kindly ask yourself, hey, body, what do you need? Do you need rest? Do you need sleep? Do you need food? And that creates an environment where you can tune into your body and build trust with your body. And that's everything in intuitive eating.
Oh, you just answered that so beautifully. And I love the contrast too here of like what's going on a physiological level. When you are shaming yourself, you're literally, your body registers there's a threat. And that threat, you are the predator. Like you are your own predator. And that has a physiological response. It's activating a stress response, which as you're sharing, isn't making it any easier for you to hear your cues or take care of yourself. And something I learned from Kristen Neff is like on the flip side, the self-compassionate voice, she says, activates, I think it's called the mammalian care system.
So the fight or flight system we talk about is the sympathetic nervous system, right? The fight or flight, you know, all your anxiety and your stress hormones are released. The opposite system to that is the parasympathetic nervous system. And the nicknames for that is either the mammalian care system, but I like this other nickname better, which is the rest and digest system. Right? Yes. So the rest and digest completely opposite to that fight or flight. And it's so relevant to intuitive eating because you can't tune into your body unless you can rest, unless your body is in a state to digest the foods and feel the foods. And that's a state where instead of the stress hormones, your body is releasing oxytocin, that same hormone, feel good hormone that comes out when mothers are holding their babies. And that's where the mammalian care system name came from.
Right. Oh, so cool. I use the term rest and digest with my clients as well, because it really helps understand of like, no, speaking to myself kindly isn't just like this fruity, floofy thing as you're describing. It literally is changing my physiology to help me better handle the food that I'm having, better metabolize, better digest. And one thing that I learned too about the mammalian care system is that speaking to yourself kindly is like that calm, soothing voice of like a mother, or like animals like purring, and literally taps into like mothering yourself in a really supportive, healing way. And I think that's such a beautiful way to frame it.
Yeah. There's actually three ways that she talks about that will actually activate that rest and digest system, that mammalian care system on a physiological level. And the soothing voice is one of them. Physical touch is another one, and warmth is one of them. And so, you know, just hugging ourselves can do all of that, right? It's like the warmth, it's the touch. And I also use the example of, you know, anytime you see a disaster movie and the 911 comes, what is the first thing that they do? They put a blanket over you and give you a cup of tea. And that's doing all of those things, the warmth, the kind of the physical aspect. And when you get a hug from someone, so even if you can't speak nicely to yourself, you can always still hold, you know, a warm cup of tea or hug your loved one, hug your pet. And so there are ways we can activate it from the physiological level, even when you're working on that self-talk aspect.
So cool. The human body is so cool. And the example about what happens when 911 comes, the blanket, and I've taken like a wilderness first responder course, and they're always like, say like, because if someone's in shock, you want to try to help them, you know, come down from that. And yeah, getting like a warm liquid in their hands to help, you know, connect to that, that's the senses. It's such a, I've never thought of it in that way. That's so cool.
Yeah.
Okay. Awesome. Mia, I could talk to you forever. I'm going to hit you with a few rapid fire questions that are fun. The first one is, what is your biggest diet culture pet peeve?
The language around it, you know, just all the guilt tripping language. I just picked up a LaCroix box and it said zero sodium, zero sugar, innocent. Yes. That makes me so angry. All these like little ways that diet culture, you know, is so insidious in our everyday lives.
Yeah. The infusing of morality where you didn't ask for it. You're like, I just want to have a seltzer. I don't need to add, you know, morality to this. Mm-hmm. What does intuition mean to you, and how do you experience it?
Intuition to me is just getting quiet and tapping into my own inner wisdom. And to me, it's just a self-trust, self-building practice of getting rid of the outside noise and just getting calm and asking myself, oh, what do I need and want? And that's something that I continue to try to practice in my own life.
Yeah. When you do something that's aligned with your intuition versus something that isn't, how does it physically manifest in your body?
I think it just releases the tension and the anxiety when, you know, when I'm operating from a frantic level of, oh, I should do this. Here are all the things I should doing. Like I'm doing it out of fear and I feel frantic, as opposed to, oh, this is what I truly feel I want to do. And it's, I trust myself and it feels good. And there's just this release of tension of that calming nervous system feeling that we just talked about.
So beautiful. That resonates with me. Thank you so much, Mia. I want to ask, is there anything we missed or anything on your heart that you're feeling called to share?
I just appreciate that we have this community and that we get to have these conversations and just continue to grow and learn from each other. So yeah.
Awesome. Thank you. And where can someone find you to learn more about your work or stay connected?
Yeah. So you can find me at my website, foodbodypeace.com, or on Instagram, and I'm at foodbody.peace.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Mia.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this episode, if it inspired you, if you learned something, it would mean so much to me if you rated it and reviewed it.
And if you feel called to, share it with someone who it might resonate with. You can find me on Instagram at leahkern.rd. You can also join my weekly newsletter by visiting leahkernrd.com. And I'll see you next week.